Good morning again. So we're thinking a bit over these last few weeks about who Jesus is. Beth started us off a couple of weeks ago looking at the story of the 5,000, feeding of the 5,000. And this week and next week, we're looking at John's version of that story. And he devotes a whole chapter, a very long chapter with about 70 verses, to reflecting on the miracle and who Jesus actually is. So I've just nearly finished reading a novel. I don't generally read novels. I'm quite interested in history, but Lois belongs to a book group, and they read this novel called The Burgess Boys recently and gave it 9 out of 10, so I thought I'll give it a go. That sounds quite promising. And I'm terrible at novels. I kind of put them down for about 6 weeks and then forgot where I was and all that kind of stuff, and so it goes on. But anyway, there was an interesting expression in it which has stuck with me. So it's one of the characters. She's on to her second marriage. She's better off financially than she was in the first one. She's found her place in polite society, but has this nagging feeling that she's, and that was the thing at the beginning of the service, she's living the wrong life. I just found that phrase fascinating, the wrong life. I tend to think in terms of best or worst life, you know. My best life would be on the central podium, you know, getting the gold medal and just, you know, that reward, you know, even though 39 other people went in for the event and didn't get it, if I could be the person who had it, that would make me really, really pleased. Other people, you just want to go for a cruise on the Mediterranean and you want to eat loads of food and sunbathe and have those. That we tend to think in those, what would my best life actually look like? And yet, in the book, it's throwing up this question, not best and worst, but right and wrong. And she feels that she's living the wrong life. Anyway, Jesus says, I am the bread of life. Now, that is an absolutely stunning statement. Bread is all about appetite, isn't it? Sustenance, satisfaction. And it would be far too trite for me to say that all Christian believers have found satisfaction and that everyone else hasn't found satisfaction, because that would clearly need a more informed debate and discussion. And I can vouch for that after 40 years of pastoral ministry. You know, there were many Christians that I came across who were really quite sad people and not satisfied with their lives at all. And all sorts of circumstances crowd in to make that happen to all of us. But before we get into this passage in John chapter 6, let me make three initial observations. Bread is an image common to most, if not all, countries. It's a staple food like milk and eggs and fruit. I was saying over at St. George's this morning, funny thing about supermarkets is the way they take all the staple foods and spread them all out. So you come into the fruit, don't you, and then you wander down and the milk is down the far end. Then they've got all lots of processed stuff that you shouldn't really be buying, but you do. And then eventually you come down the final aisle and there's the bread. You know, why couldn't they put the milk and the bread and the fruit all together in one aisle? You could have just dealt with it and got out quickly. But no, supermarkets are clever, aren't they? They know how to get your money. And so you get into all sorts of unhealthy eating. But bread, fundamental. John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, actually wrote a book called The Primitive Physic. Sounds like an A-level, doesn't it? But it's actually The Primitive Doctor. And he had all sorts of suggestions. He had a cure to baldness, actually, which was if you rub onions and honey on your head every day, your hair starts growing again. As you can see, it doesn't work. But he had all sorts of great ideas. And he actually ate bread for a year, just bread, had nothing else. Well, drank, obviously, but the only thing he ate was bread for an entire year. So it's something that's very common to us all. Secondly, John's Gospel records that Jesus made 7 statements where he introduced the statement with the words, I am. The very first one, as you see, is the bread of life. Elsewhere, he claims to be the light of the world, the good shepherd, the resurrection of the life, and you can see the other ones on the screen. Now, you or I might be inclined to say that God is the bread of life, but Jesus said that he is, and that is a staggering claim that you have to take very seriously. Now, Jesus' first listeners were not like you and me. Their minds were not coloured by 2,000 years of church tradition. And their prophets, like Moses and Elijah, had performed some extraordinary miracles as well. But they didn't claim to be the bread of life. If they'd said it, they would have said, God is the bread of life. So there's a conversation going on here where Jesus' listeners and the people that were around him were trying to figure out who he was. Is he another prophet? Well, he seems to be claiming a lot more than that. And therefore, how they should respond to him. C.S. Lewis famously said, the author of the Narnia series, Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, and all those other the seven books, he famously said, let's not have all this stuff that Jesus is a good bloke. Because basically, he said, Jesus was either mad or he was bad or he was God. He was either so deluded that he made claims to be God. I love the story of the fairly new nurse in a psychiatric hospital who went into a particular wing, and somebody came up to them and said, God has told me to do this. And the nurse said, well, are you sure that God told you to do that? And a voice from across the room said, yep, I told him to do that. You know, you get some very wacky people around who think that they're suddenly angels or prophets or gods or whatever, don't you? Either Jesus was mad or he was bad, that he deluded people, that he conspired to confuse people and mess with their heads and led them down a path that was totally wrong, or he was God. But, said C.S. Lewis, let's not have all this he's a good guy stuff. Either you take him or you dismiss him. That's the way that you should deal with Jesus. That's the second observation. Third observation is that the feeding of the 5,000 is the third of seven miracles which John describes as signs. And there you have the miracles in front of you. It's simply... Now, a signpost is not a destination. It's my favourite sign there. I should have a picture of me on a bike underneath that. Ham sandwich has to be the best sign, doesn't it, in the whole of the UK and not far from here. But it simply points you in the right direction and your journey continues. You don't stop with a miracle, but you move on from that about, so who is this person who performed the miracle? So John later states that he only chose a small selection of signs. And you've got that verse from the end of the gospel there. These are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So those three things just by way of introduction. Then I want to make two points from the passage as briefly as I can. First of all, there's a conversation being had about Moses, which is in verses, well, it's the whole passage really, verses 25 to 35. Now, Moses is perceived by Jews as the greatest of their ancestors. He was the agent of God's judgment on Egypt, the one who led God's people across the Red Sea, the one who delivered God's law to the people and then finally brought them to the brink of the promised land. And he did all of that after he turned 80 years old. But have you ever asked the question, who is the second greatest person to the Jews? When they look at their scriptures, who is the one that they pick out as the second greatest? Now, I would have gone for Abraham. I don't know about you. You might have gone for Elijah or Elisha or maybe one of the prophets, something like that. But apparently, and I'm told by probably the greatest Old Testament scholar there is in the world still living, it's Ezra. He is the person who is esteemed more than anybody else. And the reason is that whereas Moses gave Israel the law, and then life went horribly wrong and they finished up in Babylon in exile and eventually came back, it was Ezra who brought the law back to the people. So it has been said that the three greatest moments in biblical history, the moments which generate the most reflection from its writers, with the three E's, Exodus, exile, and Easter, Moses, Ezra, Jesus being the characters that are associated with that. Anyway, that's not a vital point this morning, but I thought you might be interested. John 6 has a long conversation about Moses and the manna that the Israelites ate in the wilderness. Within later Judaism, this became a kind of metaphor for God's wisdom falling from heaven, most clearly in the Ten Commandments and other laws given to Moses on Mount Sinai, but also the wisdom literature and all of that stuff that came. And the question in the people's minds was Jesus feeding of the 5,000, another bread miracle, on a par with Jesus feeding of the Israelites with this stuff, which was a kind of bread that they called manna? Now, Exodus 16 actually says that the people were fed with manna on a daily basis for 40 years. None fell from heaven on the Sabbaths, but on Fridays there was a double quantity. People took enough so they didn't have to go out and work on the Sabbath. By contrast, Jesus' feeding of the 5,000 was a one-off. So surely that made him inferior to Moses. You can see how their minds are working. So it seemed reasonable for the people to ask Jesus for an additional sign. If you think you're the Messiah, you know, give us another sign, a better sign, something superior to anything Moses ever did. Well, now you're asking, aren't you? I mean, how on earth do you grade miracles? How do you do better than dividing the Red Sea? How do you do better than calling fire down from heaven and consuming gallons and gallons of water? How on earth do you do that? What makes one miracle greater than another miracle? And actually, if you read the passage, the people even use the word sign that John is using, because the other gospel writers use the word miracle, but John uses this word sign or signpost, if you like. So there's a kind of an irony. So the people say, so what other sign can you give us? They're kind of missing the point, aren't they? Because a signpost is supposed to point you away from itself and towards the reality. Now, if I see a poster in Ramsgate advertising a jazz festival in Broadstairs tomorrow night, and then tomorrow night I turn up where I saw the poster, where absolutely nothing is happening, you would rightly conclude that I'm a bit of an idiot. A signpost is there to point you somewhere else. And that's the point that the people had missed. They got so consumed and absorbed with the miracle itself that they couldn't see it pointing away towards Jesus. What they needed to do was to have a conversation with Jesus, to sit down with him and say, so who are you? What do you stand for? What's going on here? Why are you here? They needed to have that kind of conversation, but they just simply got stuck on the miracle and said, well, give us another one of those, will you? The greatest miracle in the Bible is that Jesus, the bread of life, came down from heaven and lived and taught and died to save our human race. And all other Jesus miracles were signs pointing to him. And you read the passage and you see he talks about that. He's the source of forgiveness, new beginnings, direction in life, a right set of values. And maybe it wasn't easy for Jesus' first listeners to get their heads around that. But that's where John 6 is leading you. And next week we'll be jumping to the end of the chapter, to the point where people say, we like your miracles, but we don't like what you're saying to us. And lots of people leave him. And Jesus says to his disciples, are you lot going to go as well? C.S. Lewis, again, says that the real wonder of Christmas is not that a baby was born in a cattle feeding trough around the back somewhere in Bethlehem. The real wonder of Christmas is that God became a human being. Said it's like a man becoming a worm, human being becoming a worm. That is the wonder, that God became human in order to save this human race. And so all of these signposts are pointing to Jesus and thinking about who Jesus really is. So that's the conversation. Now the motivation, secondly, in verses 26 and 27. Because behind every question that the crowd asks, there's probably another question. One of these things you learn in life is somebody asks you a question. You sort of sit there and think, What are they really asking? What's really bugging them? Sometimes they haven't phrased the question quite right, or it seems quite an innocent question, quite a straightforward question, but there's another question niggling away in the background. So Jesus preempts that, and he says, "Very truly I tell you, you're looking for me, not because you saw the signs I performed, but because you ate the loaves and had your fill." That's what they really liked about Jesus. "Don't work for food that spoils, but for food that endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you. For on him, God the Father has placed his seal of approval." Put it another way, they're not happy with who Jesus claims to be, but they're very happy with what he does, especially when it benefits them. They eat and they're satisfied. And I just want you to hold on to that phrase for a moment. They happily eat, but they don't really want to go any further with Jesus. And that's the issue that John is describing in this chapter. Now, we're all consumers. We shop at the place that gives us more for less, don't we? In other countries, we go and haggle for the goods, and we drive people down till the price. And we did this in Morocco. Everything was priced at 300, and invariably we got them down to 20 to get it. We actually went into a shop where I assumed there were fixed prices to get some argan oil, and as we walked out, having refused to buy it because it was too expensive, the owner of the shop followed us down the street, and after about 100 yards he said, all right, I'll give it to you for 200 or whatever it was we offered. But then the trouble is, I sometimes think we've haggled him down, but that makes his life harder, makes our life easier, but it makes his life a lot harder. And we do the same with church, don't we? We shop around for a church that does and says what we want. Not a church that's going to stretch us. We're tempted to avoid the uncomfortable, and we rarely engage with Jesus' unsettling words about taking up a cross and what that might mean. I was impressed years ago by a quote from the late A.W. Tozer, American pastor, died in the early 1960s. In the years after the World War II, there was a new phrase which was bubbling up in evangelical Christianity and was part of the big crusades that were taking place. And it was this phrase, "accept Christ." Will you accept Christ? Will you accept Jesus into your heart? This was a kind of new phrase. We think it's been around forever, but it was actually quite a new phrase after the Second World War. And so Tozer just took that phrase and he turned it into a picture. And he pictured Jesus, cap in hand, standing before us, looking for a job. And we look him over to assess whether he will be worth our investment. And Tozer said, "We have subtly twisted the call to conversion. Truth is that he is the one doing the accepting, not us. He calls us to follow him. Doesn't come into our lives. He calls us to come into his life." And so back to the beginning. Are you living the wrong life? Perhaps you've done well. You've got a good family, you've got money, you've had a good job, maybe you've even got status. But there's still something niggling away, saying, "I'm living the wrong life." Jesus says he is the bread of life, the one who sustains. And yet there is something strangely repellent about that, opting to follow him, and at the same time, something profoundly attractive. He calls you to something harder, but also to something higher. It's about giving rather than receiving. If you want to be great, he says, you need to become the servant of all. The worst thing about becoming the servant of all is that after a while, people treat you like servants. During these Olympic Games, the ambition of every athlete will be to stand on that middle podium with the gold medal, exalted high above every other opponent. But when Jesus was exalted high, the spectacle was truly horrifying. And John remembered Jesus' nuanced words, "If I am lifted up, I will draw all people to me." It's at the cross that we see the true glory of God in an act of loving sacrifice. So we are called to make our responses to Jesus. Which life will we choose? The wrong one or the right one? Now, I often quote the words of the Irish poet Sidney Lysaght. In his poem, The Penalty of Love, he wrote these profound and moving and very perceptive words. If love should count you worthy and should deign one day to seek your door and be your guest, pause ere you draw the bolt and bid him rest, if in your old content you would remain. For not alone he enters, in his train are angels of the mists, the lonely quest, dreams of the unfulfilled and unpossessed, and sorrow and life's immemorial pain. He wakes desires you never may forget. He shows you stars you never saw before. He makes you share with him forevermore the burden of a world's divine regret. How wise you were to open not, and yet how poor if you should turn him from the door. Life is complicated. I've got that over the years. And Jesus never claimed to be the answer. He claimed to be the way. Sunday mornings are all about getting Jesus and his message in focus. And hopefully we've done that this morning. So may the reflections of my mind and the ruminations of all our hearts be acceptable in your sight, our Lord and our Redeemer. Amen.